say that to Jerry. Just did a wonderful job. Continues to do that. Last case, 03-0471, Julie L. Weber versus Angeline White. 25 is Jonathan Grove, representing the Webbers. Then we're going to hear from Michael Arvizio, is it, for 30 minutes, and then Mr. Grove will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Oh, I'm sorry. Something very important. The second time I've one time I'm excused, the second time it's the court to you all. So starting on my far right is Justice Diane.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Groth, and I represent the petitioner in this matter. The issue before this court is the foundation of the jury system. A witness's credibility and the weight of his testimony are left to the jury, not to appellate courts. The 1969 Ianni decision is not applicable to the case before this court. The appellate court erred by not applying the proper standards of review. Special deference is afforded to a jury's verdict that is upheld by a trial court, which was the instance in this case. An appellate court must view the evidence in a light most favorable to the jury's verdict. The credibility of witnesses and the weight given to their testimony is for the jury, and all courts must search the record for evidence that sustains the jury's verdict, all of which were not in place or taken into account in this instant case by the appellate court. The Ianni decision should only be applied in the most extreme cases. This is noted in the Lyles v. Employers Mutual case, Court of Appeals case from 1985. It's important to also note that the Lyles case was not cited by the Court of Appeals. The Ianni no-case rule is not applicable. There are four elements of the Ianni no-case rule. Number one, that a party relies on one witness to state a given item. The testimony of such witness is contradictory and conflicting. There is no explanation of that contradiction, and no other facts or circumstances in the case tend to show which version of the evidence is true. Every one of those elements are not met. The Ianni no case rule should not apply.
Now, which one is it met, counsel? Because when I look at the direct examination, I know that the chiropractor indicated that Weber, and he testified to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty, that Weber would require 20 to 25 visits a year. We know that. And for the next 35 years, it's $60. And my question then on the, as we say, the cross-examination, he basically retracted each and every statement except the fact that I guess there was not a question on the permanent shoulder impingement. And you cited the case, so which one of those four was not met?
Your Honor, I would say all four are not met because...
Well, now there was one witness, and that was... Okay.
So that
was met, wasn't it?
Correct.
Okay.
There was one witness that talked about future medical expenses. There were actually two doctors that testified about future pain and suffering. But with regard to the contradictory and conflicting statement, on direct examination, Dr. Hanasek talked about averages and about what would occur in the future based on what he saw in the previous year as the treating physician. Now, he testified that on average, he would probably see her 20 to 25 times per year for the rest of her life, which was 35 years. On cross-examination, he was asked specifically, my understanding is you've rendered the opinion to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty that she is going to come in 20 to 25 times a year for at least the next 35 years. Now, that's different than on average for the next 35 years. He also explains, well, when he's asked that specific question, he has to explain why he's not stating per year for the next 35 years. His answer is, that's an example of what we've seen this year. That does not mean, I mean, next year I may only see her only three times. It depends on what is happening with her. I think that's the the key throughout his testimony, he has said that she is on an as-needed basis as comes to or with regard to chiropractic care.
What did he testify to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty then? What was his testimony to a reasonable degree?
To a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty, he stated that on average he will see her 20 to 25 times for the rest of her life per year.
Now, I've got the right. I'm looking at the cross-examination. So you're not saying to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty she is going to be in 20 to 25 times for the next 35 years. He said, no, I'm not. I'm just saying she is going to be there if she's got pain. You can't really give us a ballpark figure as to how many times you need to see her next year. And the answer, you correct me if I'm reading this wrong, he said, no, I can't. And next he said, or the year after that, no, I can't. Or 35 years from now, no, I can't. Now, if that was the end of the testimony, that was the end of the testimony, but there was no redirect.
There was no redirect. I believe that after he talked about the 35 years from now, he also then reaffirmed later on cross-examination that she was on an as-needed basis and would need to come in for care in the future. I believe that is in the record. I think it's page 41, if I'm not mistaken. It's petitioner's appendix, page 41. It's the record document 45, page 39, where he states, she is discharged every time she is feeling good. I tell her, okay, if you have problems, we'll see her. So he does testify after the last question about a specific year, 35 years from now, he testifies that on an as-needed basis, he'll need to see her when she has pain, which is consistent with what he said throughout his entire testimony, that she has a permanent condition, which is going to cause loss of range of motion, weakness, disability, pain and suffering, and because of this permanent condition, she's going to have pain in the future, and when she has pain, she will need to see a doctor. And that is something that is consistent throughout the entire testimony. That's something that explains the contradiction, but I would put forth that there was no contradiction in the first place because we're talking about averages on one aspect. On the other aspect, we're talking about specific years. For example, Dr. Hanasek could have stated that next year he'll see her 3 times, and the year after that he'll see her 47 times. On average, that's 25 times. But he was not willing to give a specific number for a specific year and then allow defense counsel to come forward and say something like, well, doctor, you don't have a crystal ball, or you can't say for certain what's going to happen next year because no one can say for certain. I think there's case law like the Pucci versus Roche case. It's a 1971 case that's cited in other cases that were cited before the court. Pucci states that when a doctor said that it's speculative when you're talking about future care, the Court of Appeals said that is there was like a miscommunication between the court and defense counsel. That speculation is not allowed, but when you're talking about future care, speculation to some extent is needed, is necessary, because no one has a crystal ball.
So you are indicating that the jury did not have to speculate, but they would have to speculate because it's not for certain. Any of this would not be for certain. Now, if you multiply out the 60 times 25, and I think you're talking in the neighborhood of $50,000.
Correct.
So is it your argument that, well, the jury had something to go on and they just chose a figure?
Your Honor, actually, I think if you look at it's record 45, page 37, where Dr. Hanasek says, that is an example of what we've seen this year. That does not mean, I mean, next year I may only see her only 3 times. Now, that was in response to a question on cross-examination. Defense counsel did what defense counsel does, and that is whittled down damages. They took the damages from 20 to 25 times a year down to 3 times a year.
No, I have to say that we have the record here, but in the briefs that we were given, That's not in the briefs, correct? Just so I get it correctly.
I believe that this particular sentence is in the Court of Appeals decision when the court,
okay.
The Court of Appeals cites to specific language. And he testifies to three times per year. If you take three times per year times $60 for 35 years, I believe it's around $6,300. So the jury was able to come to some kind of determination, and they found that it was either between two or three visits per year that would be required because there was permanent pain and suffering. Now, counsel never asked regarding specific years on direct examination. Therefore, there is not a direct contradiction because there is not a contradiction because there's not the question asked. Dr. Hanisek also explained his previous testimony throughout. On cross-examination, it's important to note that there are at least five different times where Dr. Hanisek states that Ms. Weber will need to be seen if she has pain. He stated that if she came in with pain, if she comes in with symptomatology, she is seeking relief. So anything we can do to relieve the pain, yes, I'll need to see her. Those kind of statements stating that she's going to need to come in when she has pain, and on the other hand, where it's certain that she will have pain and suffering for the rest of her life, and that was accompanied by two different doctors stating the same thing, that in and of itself is an explanation as to what the future care will be and an explanation as to why he can't give for certain what's going to happen in a certain given year. Judge Cooper upheld the jury's verdict. He stated, "I feel it wasn't pure speculation on their behalf, and there was something more than just what he said on that cross-examination as it relates, and I'm not going to touch the jury's verdict." Judge Cooper mimics the Lyles Court statement. In Lyles, the Court of Appeals said that the Iani decision, or the Iani no-case rule, should be used in only the most extreme cases. In fact, over 35 years, the no-case rule has never really been applied. It's been talked about. Even in the Iani case, it was discussed, but it wasn't applied. This court should not apply the Iani no-case rule, and it should uphold the court's verdict, or the court's upholding of the jury's verdict. Dr. Hanisek's testimony was that there would be a permanent disability and pain forever. He stated on direct examination, "Is it your opinion that her shoulder impingement will be something that she'll have forever?" And he said, "Yes, it is."
Also, yes. I've just gone over the Court of Appeals decision, and I fail to see that. I'm not saying my colleague has a record down there, but they did say that Dr. Hanisek was the only expert witness to testify on the issue of future health care expenses.
Correct.
That is correct.
Dr. Hanisek was the only expert to talk about future health care expenses. There was another expert who testified via video about future pain and suffering, which is what Dr. Hanisek also testified to. So that is why we believe defense counsel has not appealed the issue of future pain and suffering. There was an award of $8,000 for future pain and suffering.
Well, I wanted to ask about that. On the special verdict, do the figures on the special verdict all hang together? Can you extrapolate anything about when did the accident happen? What year?
The accident happened, I believe, in 1998.
And the jury was making this finding when?
In 2002, I believe it was October of 2002.
So we have close to 4 years or 3.5 years? Something.
Approximately, yes.
And the past suffering, past pain and suffering was 5,000?
Sorry, was that a question? I apologize.
Yeah, the past pain, suffering, and disability was 5,000 over that 3.5, 4-year period.
Correct.
and the past health care expenses would be $4,400 plus $13,800. Is that 17, what, close to $18,000, something
correct.
Like that?
There is the stipulated amount and then the disputed amount, correct.
Okay.
And then the future pain and suffering was $8,000 and future health care expenses $5,000.
Well, is there anything consistent or inconsistent about the $5,000 for future health care costs?
I think it is consistent with what Julie Weber testified to and what Dr. Hanasek testified to. Dr. Hanasek testified to the fact that he had seen her for approximately 1 year prior to the trial, that he had helped her deal with her pain over that year, and he gave as an example how she was treated in that previous year, and he stated that it is an example of what might be seen in the future. He stated that she was seen on approximately 4 different occasions in the beginning of the year, and she was a school teacher. The shoulder impingement affects people when they, for example, put things on bulletin boards. She had a flare-up come September when school began. So she wasn't seen all that much, and I think that's exactly what Dr. Hanasek said. She wasn't seen all that much after taking the September on dates out of the picture. She was seen 4 or 5 times, maybe a little bit more than that, prior to her schooling. So the jury could say that, theoretically, if Ms. Weber stopped working, she may only need to see a chiropractor a couple times a year just to get adjusted and to get back to a point where she can tolerate the pain. So it is consistent in that, and I believe the math is that if it's 3 times per year for 35 years at $60 a visit, it's $6,300 or thereabouts. So the jury gave between 2 and 3 visits a year for that 35 years. Again, the jury could say that she might not live 35 years. You know, they were the ones to know what she did, what kind of person she was, and they may have said, well, 30 years is better, 25 years, what have you. That's the inferences, I think, that and the speculation right now that we have, and therefore we have to apply the inferences in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict. So that's why I'm applying in that manner.
Was there anything in the record that considered the possibility of something more than chiropractic care? I mean, in any possibility of surgery or?
This is a soft tissue injury where it's permanent, but there is no other type of way to stop the pain, I guess is the best way to put it. Dr. Shoham testified on the video that this was an injury that she had treatment with two doctors, her family doctor, I think it was Dr. Evanson, and then Dr. Shoham. It got to a point where they just couldn't do anything more. Julie was referred then to a chiropractor by a friend, and that chiropractor seemed to help the pain. So Dr. Shoham testified that he's eclectic that way, that if it's going to help you, go and do it. So he said, well, if you want to go see chiropractic care, go and see chiropractic care, and she did, and it helped. And that's why Dr. Hanasek testified to future pain future medical expenses, because he was the one that she would have seen in the future if she did have pain and suffering and needed some relief.
How does this differ from any personal injury case where you're going to need care? No one knows precisely what kind of care. Might get really bad, might get better by itself. So how does this case differ from all other cases that raise this issue?
Your Honor, I'm not quite sure if it actually does, to be honest with you. I think that this is, I don't want to say a typical case, but soft tissue permanent injury cases are frequent. I can say I've had 4 in the past year. Those are cases where defense counsel are more apt to fight and take to a jury because there is no objective finding of injury. So this is a case where a knee basis, palliative relief, as opposed to a gangrenous knee where it has to be removed or a fusion.
Let me ask the same question somewhat differently.
Sure.
If you were sitting where I'm sitting and had to write this opinion, how do you write it? So that on the one hand, we take into account that it's a soft tissue injury and no one can predict the future. And at the other hand, don't condone, in effect, the jury speculating or guessing. I mean, that's what your opposing counsel is going to say. No evidence and a lot of speculation. So how do you write it so that we get sort of a balance and in the middle of that?
Your Honor,
and I'm going to ask your opposing counsel the same question.
Okay. I think, Your Honor, you have to put emphasis on the Lyles Court decision that this is an extreme case, that the Ianni no case rule should only be used in the most extreme of situations. The instant case is not extreme. The instant case is not a situation where all three out of the four elements are met. This court should be stringent when it deals with those other three elements. They all must be met, and there must not be any question as to those three elements. In this situation, those three elements are all not only questionable, but there is evidence to contradict and to not apply those three elements. I think that as this relates to other soft tissue injuries, my ideal situation would be that the court says if there is a prima facie case made for future pain and suffering, future medical expenses, and counsel on cross-examination whittles the damages down or raises some kind of speculation, that should be left for the jury, and that it should be a jury question no matter what.
What I found interesting or curious was there was no redirect, and I think that would have been very helpful. That's so that the jury would have been able to understand exactly what you're saying here today, that it could have been two, it could have been four times a year. He really didn't know. And because there was no response to the cross-examination, and he said, well, I'm not testifying to a reasonable certainty. That was what was concerning me as far as you indicated that the four factors were not there.
And Judge Cooper actually asked the same question of Attorney Kyle. And Attorney Kyle's answer was, listening to the questions, Dr. Hanisek answered the questions that were asked of him. He answered questions regarding certain years. His previous testimony was about averages. And you can read the struggle that Dr. Hanisek was struggling to answer the questions and still give his opinion about averages. Dr. Hanisek wasn't going to say about certain years. He was going to talk about averages, and that's about it. Number one, Dr. Hanisek answered the questions that were asked of him. And number two, counsel has to, at some point, make the strategic decision to let sleeping dogs lie. If you raise the question, if you raise it on cross-examination, and then it's raised again on redirect, and then there's another recross, redirect, when is it going to end? In some cases, if the court finds in favor of the respondent in this matter, my fear is that you're going to have cases go on for a longer period of time because whoever gets the last word in edgewise is going to prevail because you have somebody who's going to say, well, that's not quite certain, is it? Well, no. Well, then you're going to get recross and redirect on the same thing that was stated on direct examination. And whoever talks last could win. In this case, you have to look at explanations throughout the entirety of the testimony, and I think that's important when you're looking at the language that the Supreme Court used back in 1969 with regard to the no-case rule. It said no other facts or circumstances in the case tend to show which version of the evidence is true. The case should be seen as the entirety of the case, not just a snippet on cross-examination. And that's what the Lyles decision also stated, was you can take a certain snippet out of context. You have to look at the entirety of the case, the entirety of the testimony. Dr. Hanisek's testimony was clear. It talked about averages. It talked about permanent disability. And taking into account the entirety of it, that is what is enough for the jury to award a verdict of $5,000 in future medical expenses.
Mr. Groh, before your time is up, I'm
sure
interested in asking about another issue. Apparently, there's a desire on the part of the other side to pay money into the clerk's office, and you've opposed that on behalf of your client. Would you explain to us why you're opposing that?
Well, I'm opposed. opposing it first off with regard to the Supreme Court because counsel never raised that on a cross petition. Because they did not raise it, I think it's the A.O. Smith case states that it cannot be considered by the Supreme Court. We opposed that when it came down to the trial court level because if management computer services and the Scullion factors, if you take those into consideration, the trial court found that those factors were not met with regard to this case. Ms. Weber would have been, in essence, harmed, which is one of the factors, because she would not have the use of her money. Also, with regard to...
She doesn't have the use of her money now, does she?
Well, but she has... If she would not have... let me rephrase that. If Ms. Weber would have had the money put into the clerk's account, the 12% interest would be washed away. It would be, instead of 12% interest per year, it would be whatever the clerk's account would bring. And my time is up, but I'll, may I answer?
I'm sure you can go
Thank
ahead
you.
And finish.
Yes.
The money would not have been earning the 12% per year as the statute dictates. The court found that because of that, and the court used its discretion finding that because of that, she was harmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Vestio, representing Angeline White and Farmers Insurance Exchange.
Yeah, my name is Attorney Mike Vestio. May it please the court. And I represent Angeline White and Farmers Insurance Exchange. And with me is Attorney Brian Remington also today. This case is about the scope of a jury's prerogative at trial. Put simply, the chiropractor who testified at the trial gave irreconcilable contradictory testimony as to the amount of future chiropractic expenses. My clients maintain that such fundamentally contradictory testimony is, as a matter of law, incredible. The discretion we give juries is wide, but it is not unfettered. And as a matter of fundamental fairness, juries' decisions must be tethered to genuine evidence.
What's wrong with the answer that opposing counsel gave that, well, he said this on the average, so that's what the jury looked at?
If you look at the actual testimony...
Well, we were trying to look at it, okay. And I was looking at what was in the Court of Appeals and then in the briefs, and we've got the actual... Is there a misstatement on what happened in the actual testimony?
In the Court of Appeals decision?
Yes.
No, it's accurate. And what happened is, on direct examination, the word average was used by Dr. Hanasek in response to a question about a general idea of what the future medical expenses would be. The question was stated in terms of, can you give us an idea? And the answer was, yeah, the average will be, and then the familiar figures, 20 to 25 visits per year on average for, well, actually, he doesn't say 35 years until later in his testimony, and later in his testimony he says $60 per visit. That's the testimony on direct. On cross, you actually need to take the passages that are quoted by the Court of Appeals, and sort of break them into two different parts. The first part is the question where defense counsel actually said, it's my understanding that to a reasonable degree of professional probability, you're stating 20 to 25 visits, $60, 35 years. And Dr. Hanasek says something to the effect of, no, I'm not. Now, if you look at what the question actually asked was, that question contained two parts. One was a year. The quote actually from counsel's question is, quote, a year. How much a year is it going to be? I think right there you've got something that comes pretty close to asking for an average in reasonable English speakers' interpretations of a question. But then he goes on to say for 35 years. Now, I don't know how Dr. Hanasek can interpret that question, not talking about the ballpark questions that come later. I don't know how Dr. Hanasek can interpret that question to not be asking him to give an opinion of the average over the 35 years. For 35 years, I guess the only other possibility is that he's suggesting, people who say Dr. Hanasek could misunderstand that to not be an average, would be suggesting that they're asking him to confirm that each and every one of those 35 years is going to have exactly 20 to 25 visits. That's simply not what a reasonable person would believe looking at that question.
And I don't know if the doctor thought that either, but he was talking about talking about, well, if she had pain, she'd have to come back. And what I'm trying to find out from either counsel is, well, what would a jury expect? A jury is there. They wouldn't have this exactly. They have to have some speculation. There is some guesswork in this. And that's what I'm asking you.
Yeah. A jury is permitted to listen to the testimony and take the effect of that testimony on a reasonable jury, on an English speaker, and determine whether that's a contradiction with previous testimony. There is no way that these two passages, and I'm talking about the first questions before the ballpark gets mentioned in the cross-examination and then the direct testimony, there's no way to read those passages as anything other than inconsistent. And if this court were to rule that that's not an inconsistency, that's not a contradiction, then essentially what this court is saying is that there have to be magic words. Basically, cross-examining counsel has to parrot the exact magic words said by counsel on direct examination.
Counselor, I beg to disagree with you just a bit. I mean, I think the first testimony, he was asked, did you render all the opinions you gave today to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty? He says yes, and those are when he says it's an average. And then the question that you're talking about, he says, the question, my understanding is you've rendered the opinion to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty that she is going to come in 20 to 25 times a year for at least the next 35 years. His answer is, that is an example of what we've seen this year. That does not mean, I mean, next year I may see her only 3 times. It depends on what is happening to her. I don't see anything inconsistent there. And I have a problem, if you think that's inconsistent, how you line up the special verdict where she got $8,000 for future pain and suffering with uncontradicted testimony that she's going to need treatment for pain, and then you want to give her nothing
That's
for what
not
she's going to afford for that pain. It wouldn't make any sense to have a zero in the treatment if she's going to have $8,000 worth of pain over the next however many years.
There's imprecision in my two-tier system of interpreting the cross-examination. What really should be is a three-tier system.
Okay.
That first question that you quoted,
yep,
would be the first tier, and there is no inconsistency,
right,
insofar as line 23 on page 37 of that transcript.
Okay. Show me where it's inconsistent.
Then the next question is, so you are not saying to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty she is going to be in 20 to 25 times a year. That's the a year I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then the prepositional phrase, for the next 35 years. And he
mm-hmm.
says, no, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that she's going to be there if she's got pain. That's the direct inconsistency.
Well,
you can't.
Well, but I think a jury could find that he's not going to tell you something 5 minutes over here, and over here he's going to contradict what he just said. You got the same man, the same day, talking about the same injury to the same woman. I think the jury could read it the way opposing counsel is reading it. Just they're supposed to apply their common sense. We tell them that all the time.
I don't think a reasonable person in the position of Dr. Hanasek, if he believes that the average over the 35 years is 20 to 25 visits,
right,
but believes that maybe one of those years will be a 15 visit, or
right,
one of those years is a 36 visit,
right,
I don't think he can say no to that question then. That question has to be affirmed if the average is going to come out to that 20 to 25 years.
But I think you have to look at everything he said, not one sentence that you can pick and pull apart. I think you have to look at his whole testimony, because that's what the jury's going to consider. They won't have anything written. They won't dissect his testimony. They get a feeling from what he's saying about what he believes.
And I have scoured his testimony, and I see nothing else relevant other than what we've already discussed today, either in first questioning or the other question.
I understand your concern about precision, and you're a good defense counsel, and that's what defense counsel is supposed to do, but generally juries are not quite, so precise as...
Well, if this has to be mirroring exactly what was said on direct examination, or if a jury is permitted to hear a contradiction and conclude that a witness would never contradict themselves, then that's essentially saying that the Ioni rule will never apply.
They have to perceive a contradiction. You are perceiving one. My question to you was, is it necessary that the jury perceived one, given what was said?
I think a reasonable jury has to perceive that question that begins on line 24 on page 37 of the transcript,
yep,
as directly contradictory to the preceding passage in direct examination.
Counsel, why wouldn't the jury be considered reasonable when they said, all right, we have this testimony, and the doctor could not give us an exact answer. So they did not, they chose a figure, as I asked opposing counsel, between hypothetically $50,000 and zero. And they came up with, as opposing counsel indicated, something about three times a year over a period of her life expectancy. Isn't that reasonable?
No, it's not reasonable. But in addition to that, it doesn't meet the burden of production imposed upon a plaintiff. It's the plaintiff that has to come forward with evidence and produce evidence that confirms his case. If the record is such that it looks as if the person would incur future medical expenses, but there is no evidence in the record that would suggest that, case law precedent before IONI actually says that the plaintiff has failed to meet that burden that they have to support the verdict. And even if there is a verdict rendered in their favor, it's not supported by evidence. A jury has, as I said, wide discretion, but not unfettered discretion. They make findings of fact. They don't issue naked decisions without bases. And they're not able to make a finding of fact without the facts before them in order to make that finding.
Counsel, you're a good defense attorney.
And thank you.
That's right.
Watch yourself.
No. And, of course, you know what a good, and you know, I just smile, because a good defense attorney is going to have on direct the question, as you have here, in a doctor to a reasonable, blah, 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 chiropractic probability. But then on cross-examination, the defense attorney is going to say, but doctor, to a reasonable certainty, of course, because we can use either one, and that's, you know, the technique. Then you have, on the direct examination, you have an average, let's say you're cross-examining orthopedic surgeon, board certified, you know, just credentials that no one could attack, just impeccable. And let's say, in dealing with future medical expenses, he opined that she might have to come in, get some physical therapy at his direction and see him on an average, because she has a permanent disability, of 4 or 5 times a year. Let's say he says. So now he comes to cross. Doctor, you can't say with to a reasonable degree of certainty that in 3 years from now she's going to come in 5 times that year, can you? Well, no, I can't say that. You can't say in 35 years from now, doctor, to a reasonable degree of certainty, emphasizing the certainty, that she is going to come in 5 times, can you, doctor? No. I mean, isn't that exactly what went on here?
No, it's not, because the certainty and probability discrepancy that you're describing would possibly deprive it of being a contradiction in and of itself. But IONI provides us with the perfect remedy. And the perfect remedy is counsel stands up on redirect and says, I detect a little bit of tension between what you've said on direct and what you've said on cross. Can you explain it? The doctor explains it, and now the jury, instead of speculating, do I believe A or do I believe negative A, the jury may now evaluate the reason for the perceived contradiction and decide on its own whether that is a proper...
Let's let the jury decide here. We have the threshold statement on direct. Reasonable probability average of, is it 20 to 25 times a year? Is that what it is?
That's the figures, yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, we've talked about separate sentences, but in the transcript, they all come together on cross-examination, one right after the other. This is the questioning. Question, cross-examination. My understanding is you've rendered the opinion to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty that she is going to come in 20 to 25 times a year for at least the next 35 years. Answer. That's an example of what we've seen this year. That does not mean, next year I may see her only 3 times. It depends on what's happening with her. So you're not saying to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty that she's going to be in 20 to 25 times a year for the next 35 years. No, I'm not. I'm just saying that she's going to be there if she's got pain. Question. You can't really give us any ballpark figure as to how many times you will need to see her next year. No, I can't. Or the year after that. No, I can't. Or 35 years from now. No.
If we're going to
How is that different than my hypothetical I gave you regarding this august orthopedic surgeon?
Well, now we proceed into the questions that are about the ballpark figures. Those questions about the ballpark figures are the snowballs for Dr. Hanisick. If Dr. Hanisick was really misled by the questions taken out of context that preceded those questions, he could at least say, well, I can give you a ballpark figure, I just did, or something like that. But instead, he did not. Now, one could say that ballpark figures are kind of imprecise, but I would refer the court back then to the question that begins this entire colloquy, and that is, in direct examination, can you give us any idea of future care expenses? It's not to a reasonable degree of professional certainty that they ask. It's not to a reasonable degree of professional probability that they ask. What they do instead is they wait till the end of Dr. Hanisick's testimony and they say, oh, by the way, all these answers you've previously given, those were to a reasonable degree
you've
of professional certainty.
You've seen that time in and time out in medical depositions. Sometimes the questions come in exactly like you would want them out of the textbook. Reasonable degree of medical probability, blah, blah, blah. Do you have an opinion? Yes, I do. And what is that opinion? Well, my opinion is. I mean, that's textbook. But oftentimes in the heat of question and answer, you don't get the textbook. So at the end, you say, Doctor, let me just make sure all the questions that you have answered have been to the requisite standard of a reasonable degree of medical probability. Is that correct? Yes, that is. And then it's your turn to answer the question.
If that's the choice that's made by counsel, then they have to live with the ramifications of that. And I think the ramifications of that in this case are they adopted a fulsome manner for the question, and they set the tone that the jury would perceive for defense counsel also. So do you have any fair idea of future care expenses? And no, by the way, that's to a reasonable degree of professional probability, right? Is just as precise, accurate, fair, and folksy as defense counsel asking, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of professional probability, and then proceeding to confirm that no, not even a ballpark figure could come from the doctor. Those are exactly even in their perception from the jury when taken as a whole in context, even if the standard that was stated, and I haven't actually looked at what the plaintiff's standard is, the plaintiff's standard is also to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty at line 10 on page 34. So in fact, if you take that standard and you assume that counsel really intended to ask it along with his actual folksy question about any idea, he asked to a certainty, and then cross-examination was to a certainty as well.
Counsel, your ballpark questions to me seem to give you more trouble than they give you help because they're focused on a particular year. And I don't think any of the plaintiff's questions were focused on a particular year. And that's where it seems to me you guys are like two ships passing in the night. You're both making good arguments, but you're not bumping up against each other to show me why your positions are inconsistent.
I don't think that those ballpark figures hurt me. I also don't think they display the direct contradiction that occurs at line 2 on that same page. The direct contradiction occurs, and then the ballpark figures confirm that this doctor, on cross-examination at least, isn't going to give any idea, which is exactly what he was trying
year.
To do on
for direct. A particular year. But his well, direct was based on averages, and he was careful to explain, well, she might come in 3 times, she might come in 20 times. I can't say the number for a particular year.
He's asked the average, then he's asked the particular years. He's asked about what she's going to have for 35 years.
But that's
now, that's not
a
question
years.
About specific years.
But
that's
the year says next year, and then you say in 3 years. Well,
that's later. But first he's asked about the average. First, he's asked about what's going to happen for that entire increment.
Well, but there's no statement in there about an average. It just says...
The magic word average does not appear. I concede that.
It doesn't. And it does appear, the magic word average does appear in direct.
Yes, but only in Dr. Hanisick's answer, not in the question.
Right, but the jury would be free to combine those answers and not find them inconsistent, wouldn't they? There's no direct saying, nope, I don't know what the average would be on... cross, and on direct he's saying, yep, I do know what the average would be.
No, because the jury would be unreasonable if they perceived it to be a truthful answer to the question that's asked. So you are not saying to a reasonable degree of chiropractic certainty she is going to be in 20 to 25 times a year for the next 35 years. Dr. Hanisick has in his mind, according to this hypothetical, that the average over the 35 years is that 20 to 25, but instead of saying the average like that in the same way he did on direct examination, he just negates that question. He says, no, that's not my testimony, over 35 years. If what he really believed at the time he was asked that question and gave that answer was that the average was over that 35 years, the 20 to 25, I don't see how he could give a negative response to that question.
No, witnesses can be pretty pesky. I want to shift gears on you and ask you about the second or one of the other issues that's in the case about your wanting to pay the award into court. And can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. In this case, after the verdict in the case, we made a motion to the circuit court for relief pending appeal based on the Management Computer Services case. Mm-hmm. In Management Computer Services, they allowed exactly what we sought as relief. We tendered a check to the circuit court. We wanted to be able to pay it into the circuit court, have market interest accrue to compensate Ms. Weber for the loss of her money during the time it's pending in court rather than in her hands, but to stop the statutory interest of 12%. We made that motion in the circuit court. We made that motion again on appeal when we lost in the circuit court. We made that motion in the Court of Appeals without actually appealing the circuit court decision because the statute, or actually the appellate rule that allows for this, says during the pendency of an appeal, a trial court or an appellate court, generically, it doesn't say just the Court of Appeals, may stay execution or enforcement of a judgment or order. That's the exact rule of appellate procedure that was relied on in Management Computer Services versus BAPTI, I think, is one
but
of the
But don't you have the rule of the case? If the trial court says no, don't you have to appeal that? You can't just ask another court to do the same thing, can
no,
you?
No, with motions for relief pending appeal, you can renew you have to bring the motion in the circuit court first. But then you are permitted to bring the motion in the Court of Appeals without actually appealing from any order made in the circuit court. You provide the way you always do in a Court of Appeals case. You provide the exhibits along with your motion, and counsel gets an opportunity to dispute those exhibits if he wants. And then what happened in this case, actually, is the decision in the Court of Appeals on our motion for relief pending appeal actually came about 2 weeks before the decision of the Court of Appeals in the actual case. While we were still decision on the motion, the Court of Appeals decision in this case rendered our question of interest moot. So at that point, we believed that we shouldn't bring that moot question before the court. And it was only later that we learned that the Supreme Court would take the petition for review, and we wished to renew our motion. And I believe Section 808.07 sub 2 sub A permits us to bring that request for relief in the Supreme Court.
Counsel,
directly.
I don't want to switch gears, but now there was a statutory offer here, I think, of $35,000, and then you made a countervailing offer of $20,000. This $5,000 that we're debating here becomes very important in the sense that if I understand 807.01, that if the $5,000, if opposing counsel prevails, hits the $5,000, then it falls into the category under 807.01 where there's both double, as I understand it, double interest and costs. Is that correct?
Well, it's prejudgment interest under that
correct.
Statute, but yes, that's correct.
Does that in any way affect what Justice Rubinsack is talking about?
The motion for relief pending appeal? No, they get that relief either way.
Either way.
The only question is the post-judgment statutory interest that has been conceivably accruing ever since the appeal.
If we were to say, no, that the $5,000 was sufficient and correct and et cetera, then they would be entitled to, under 807.01, the double interest and costs, correct?
If this court rules in favor of the plaintiff in the Supreme Court, no, I believe they've already got a judgment for all of the augmented costs and everything else that they would have been entitled to in the trial court. They've already got that judgment.
All right.
The judgment we appealed from incorporated those amounts.
What about the interest?
Yes.
Including the pre-judgment interest.
What about post-judgment interest?
No, the post-verdict interest is...
Between the verdict and the judgment.
Right.
That's what I think we're asking.
Between the verdict and the judgment, that's been memorialized in the judgment as well. It's only post-judgment interest that needs to be factored in for the alternative or the secondary relief that we've asked for in our brief.
Could you clarify for me, if you were writing a textbook on this case, how should the case for future medical expenses have been made?
Well, I recognize the problem of counsel not being able to control what a witness says, and so they were faced with a direct examination that had one thing said, and then the direct opposite said on cross-examination and a contradiction. Under Ayani, it's very clear that the Ayani rule will never apply again if they come back on redirect and they say, sir, I detect a tension between your two statements. How do you resolve that? And then he explains it. Even if his explanation is something less than optimal, that gives the jury the meat it needs to make its decision on whether the contradiction should reasonably be resolved in favor of one side or in favor of the other side. But without that, you've got A and negative A said by the same witness. Those two things, there's no way to reconcile them, and the jury can only speculate to pick one or the other. Said another way, all that's left after he says reasonably probable and not necessarily reasonably probable is a possibility that one is right or the other. By the same token, something I want to mention before I conclude my remarks, there's been some mention of the comment that's made about, for example, I might only see him next year for three visits, and how that might even be more consonant with what the jury actually did in this case. That, again, is not sufficient into the requisite degree of probability. It's not reasonably certain when you say, for example, three. That's not reasonably certain evidence. And so that wouldn't be enough to justify the jury's decision either, because we know from precedent that it's required that not only there be testimony that they're going to incur the medical expenses or chiropractic expenses, but that there's also going to be information about what the value of those expenses are. The value of those expenses is nothing more than a possibility on this record, even with that toss-away comment about the, for example, three visits.
Would the if you had the perfect expert witness here, would that person have been able to specify in real detail what the future medical expenses would be?
No. There's no requirement that there be mathematical certainty about future medical expenses. What is required is that they give the jury something that's to a reasonable certainty, because that's what damages need to be. They need to be, have proof to a reasonable certainty. There needs to be something that makes it reasonably certain or reasonably probable that those damages are going to be incurred. Not necessarily a guy, I mean, he wouldn't even have to be as precise as he was on direct examination. He doesn't have to give the precise numbers. What he has to do is give some amount that could be used by the jury as a foundation for a decision they make.
Counsel, I don't have in front of me the jury instruction, but you quoted part of it. That is, it doesn't have to be done with regard to future pain and suffering or future damages with mathematical precision. But then it also has in it some reference to the difference between probability for the future does not, you know, kind of equivocates. Do you know what phrase I'm talking about, or do you recall?
No, I haven't looked at the jury instruction for today.
No, I mean, it meshes with common sense that we aren't able to say with specificity when a doctor's testifying to future medical expense necessarily, but I just don't remember the words,
other
than the mathematical precision stuff that you threw out.
It's that common sense that I'm invoking when I say a person using common sense would find a contradiction between these two statements.
Is there anything you would change in the Court of Appeals opinion? Is this a favorable decision to you? Do you think that any of the language here has to be refined?
No, I think it's actually a very simple and direct decision. It sets forth the contradiction that exists. It sets forth the relevant case law, including that precedent I mentioned that talks about how you need to not only say you're going to incur the future medical expenses, but give some information about how you're going to incur or how much you're going to incur. And then it goes on to explain that the contradiction causes only speculation to be able to be utilized by the jury in resolving the contradiction. And I think that is concise and pretty pretty close to perfect decision.
Thank you, counsel.
I have a question just for clarification, if I may. The second issue that you set forth in your brief, counsel, is Ms. Weber entitled to prejudgment interest or amplified taxable costs under 807.01? But I understood from your arguments that that's not an issue. Maybe I'm wrong. Statement of issues, page 1 in your brief.
Looking for my own brief to tell me what
maybe
I'm arguing.
Am I wrong on that?
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong brief.
Yeah, it's the blue brief, and you set that forth as an issue, and yet what I heard you say was that wasn't an issue, so I just need clarification.
No, it is an issue. I may have phrased it incorrectly. I'd like to read
two
it.
Two so deals with prejudgment interest.
That's right, and I heard you say in response to, I think, both my Justice question. Wilcox and the Chief Justice.
Okay.
It's not in play.
Well, it's in play, but only technically. If we win on the principal issue, we win on that issue. The amplified costs have been incorporated into the judgment, but if the $5,000 is taken off, then that automatically, I mean, it's exactly the mandate that happened in the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, that was my question.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood.
Well, no, because the amount drops down, and therefore it would be below the $35,000 figure.
Yes.
Yeah, that's.
And those then get removed, right. It's only if counsel, Ms. Weber wins, that those stay in the judgment, and if Ms. Weber loses, then those get removed from the judgment. But that's just a consequence of what happens in issue one.
So does two fall away?
Well,
if you win?
If we win, yeah. Two doesn't fall away. It automatically gets answered yes.
It seems to me that two falls away regardless of who wins. I mean, it's a function of who wins on question one.
True.
And whoever wins on question one, if it's below $35,000, it doesn't come into play. If it's above $35,000, you've conceded that she's in under whatever it is, 807.01, they're entitled to prejudgment interest and the cost pursuant to the statute. So it's not really an issue. It's a consequence of the answer to question one. Am I right or wrong?
You're right, and I'm trying to say that, but unartfully. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Grove, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honors, opposing counsel and I agree on one thing, which is the plaintiff does not need to be precise or give precise numbers with regard to future medical expenses. I think it's important to note the standard for future medical expenses is that there must be expert testimony of a permanent injury, which is what we have, that injury will require treatment in the future, which is what we have, and that an expert must establish the cost of the treatment, which is what we have. We have the cost of treatment being $60 per visit. We have treatment required when she has pain, which is stated throughout the testimony. And I believe that in order to apply the Iani no case rule, you have to find that there is no explanation throughout the entire case. There is explanation throughout the entire case. Also, with regard to the other facts in the case, there are other facts throughout the entire case that would uphold the jury's inference that future medical care would be necessary to 3 times a year, 2 times a year, or what have you. Now,
you have here two doctors testifying to that she has a permanent disability. Is that correct, or am I wrong?
You are correct. There were two plaintiff's doctors. There was Dr. Hanasek, who was a treating chiropractor, and Dr. Shoham, who was a treating physiatrist, a treating MD. And Dr. Shoham testified regarding his care of Ms. Weber. He only cared for Ms. Weber for the first 10 months after the collision. After that, he said, there's nothing more I can do. It's permanent. Go see somebody that would help you out. And in that case, it was a chiropractor. And that's why the chiropractor testified as to the future medical, because the chiropractor was the only person that could really testify as to future care, because Julie chose to go to a chiropractor.
And then you had testify defense medical, is that correct?
There was a defense doctor that testified, likely testifying that there was no permanent injury.
Okay. Did he testify consistent with his report that I saw in the record that said if she was going to have continuing problems that she should see an follow up with an orthopedic surgeon or something like that?
Correct. And that was the testimony that was also used by defense counsel to talk with or to cross-examine Dr. Shoham about why he didn't ask Julie to go see an orthopedic surgeon. Also, I think there was testimony in Dr. Hanasek's testimony about orthopedic surgery and why there wasn't a referral off to an orthopedic. Correct.
So I'm not so sure I understand this interest issue. And you assert in your briefs that it's not properly before us because no cross appeal
correct
was set forth. Do you also assert that it's not ripe and it should be sent to the trial court?
Well, I think the standard of review with regard to this kind of situation is that of broad discretion. The trial court exercised its discretion. A court of appeals need not reverse if an independent review of the record reveals a basis for sustaining the trial court's action. The court of appeals was right in that there was ample basis for the trial court's decision, and the circuit court has broad discretion. It has broad discretion to stay in execution or enforce a judgment. That's what we're saying took place here. We believe that the court of appeals was correct in this instance, saying that there was ample discretion used, ample support for the discretion used by Judge Cooper at the trial court level.
Their argument is that if you take off the $5,000, then the award goes below $35,000.
Correct. That's
why you're not entitled, they argue.
They're arguing that we were at $36,000+, all things considered, and then if the jury's award of $5,000 for future medical expenses is taken off, then we're down to $31,000, which drops us below the $35,000 statutory offer of settlement, and then we would not be entitled to statutory interest of 12% after the judgment and not entitled to amplified costs.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, the Court of Appeals erred by not giving special deference to the verdict as upheld by the trial court. The Court of Appeals did not search for any credible evidence, and the Court of Appeals decision should be overturned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Grove. Thank you, Mr. Vesio, for your arguments today relating to the damages issue. And that concludes our hearing in 03-0471, Weber versus White.